right, welcome, and we have one case on our 230 docket. Baumaster versus Reagan and ANS Real Estate et al. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today. Did we get everybody's names correctly? All right. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Masso, if you'll begin for us, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As was just announced, my name is Jad Masso, and I represent the appellants in this case, Richard Baumeister, as well as his firm, Sanford Baumeister and Frazier. I'll probably refer to the firm just as SBNF so I don't get tongue-tied any more than I already have. This is actually, it's been combined for oral argument, but it is actually two cases that have been brought against Mr. Baumeister and SBNF, one by Plaintiff Gary Reagan. That's one case by itself, and then there's a separate case with similar issues, of course, brought by ANS Real Estate Limited, Fastlane Partners LP, and Don Smith. I may sometimes refer to that case or that group of plaintiffs as the ANS plaintiffs, just for short. In any event, this is the appeal, an accelerated appeal to be exact, of the denial of a motion to compel arbitration. The claims in these two cases center largely on the plaintiff's complaint that they were fraudulently induced or that a fiduciary duty was breached in inducing them to enter into a couple of limited partnership agreements. Both of those limited partnership agreements contain arbitration provisions that are rather broad. They both go as far as saying any dispute or controversy not only arising out of or under the agreements, but also any dispute or controversy arising in connection with or in relation to those agreements. In the court below, we filed a motion to compel arbitration as to the parties that actually became partners in the limited partnership agreements, which is all of the parties here with the exception of ANS Realty. ANS made a similar investment, but outside the actual partnership agreement, so their circumstances are a little bit different. We just moved to stay the claims brought by them since they're not actually bringing claims that connect with the contract.
And the trial court denied that motion to stay?
That's correct, Your Honor. The standard of review in this case can be a little muddy at times, but I believe the standard of review is de novo when we're looking at a pure question of law. At least a couple of courts of appeals in Texas, I know for certain the 14th court in Houston has held that when we're looking at whether an arbitration agreement covers the scope of a particular claim, that is a question of law for the court, and accordingly, when it's in the court of appeals, the review is de novo and not general under the general abuse of discretion that we look to, for example, for a factual finding made by the trial court. When we take a step back and look at the case as it is on appeal, there are essentially four issues that need to be looked at, well, that are at least...
Can I ask you why issues one and two say the trial court abused its discretion?
I think in general, when we look at a motion to compel arbitration, the review is abuse of discretion. When you drill down a little bit further, though, pure questions of law are decided de novo. And so looking at it further, as I've done over the last month, I think the questions that we have before us now, where we really are primarily talking about scope, that is a question of law. And so when we're looking at something so narrow, there really is no discretion left. And so while had there been factual findings, I think we'd be looking at an abuse of discretion. As best I can tell, and I don't mean to say that it's 100% clear to me, but I really do believe that this is a de novo review when we're talking about scope, at least. As I was saying, I think there are four issues. A couple of them are more major issues, a couple of them more minor, but tackling them in the order that I think makes the most logical sense. The first is whether the arbitration agreements in these cases are actually enforceable at all. There was an argument made by the ANS plaintiffs that they are void due to irreconcilable ambiguity. I don't think that one will take very long, but I do want to address it. Second issue, of course, being the general scope question. Are the claims brought by the plaintiffs in these cases subject to the arbitration agreement in these contracts? Third is a little bit different, and that has to do with the particular claims brought against SBNF. SBNF was not a party to the partnership agreements, but the claims are very, very similar and are essentially based on the same facts. That's the third one, and then the fourth deals with the stay issue, and in particular whether the claims brought by ANS should be stayed.
Did SBNF file a motion to compel arbitration?
They did not file a motion, Your Honor. And what happened there was Mr. Baumeister himself, as a party to the contracts, brought that motion on SBNF's behalf. And our read...
Say that in his motion, that he's bringing it on their behalf?
It says that it is asking for all of the claims to be compelled toward arbitration. And it states in there that SBNF has consented to arbitration.
In the order that was signed disposing of that motion, did it address SBNF?
I don't believe it addressed anything in particular. I think it just said the motion was denied.
So you're saying SBNF is properly before this court?
I do, Your Honor, and in particular looking at, I believe it is 171098, yes, of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, essentially says that any party may bring an appeal of an order denying a motion to compel arbitration. We believe that since SBNF was a party in the case below, even though it may not have itself brought the motion, it was affected by the order, and it is an appropriate party to this appeal. Just as a peremptory matter, I want to deal with the ambiguity issue. The law there is fairly clear, and in fact, the case that ANS cites, the T.O. Stanley case from the Supreme Court in 1992, says that a contract is void only when it is so ambiguous that the court can't determine the obligation to be enforced. And I don't think we're anywhere near that in this case. The arbitration agreement is not a model of clarity. It does have a little circular language in it because it says that disputes that have not been or cannot be resolved under Section 9.1 shall be resolved by arbitration. And if Your Honor's read this portion of their brief, it's Section 9.1 that requires arbitration. A little bit circular, granted, but I don't think it's confusing. I think it's pretty obvious what the agreement is. I don't see how there can be any dispute that this is an agreement to arbitrate matters that have not been otherwise resolved. It's not something that's subject to multiple interpretations like we'd ordinarily think of for ambiguity, and as a result, I don't think there's any question of the obligations ought to be enforced here, so I don't think there's really a question as to the validity of the ambiguity, validity based on ambiguity, but I did want to address that just as a preliminary matter. Moving on to the more meatier issue of scope, what we find in the briefs, at least I did, was that the plaintiffs, both Reagan and the ANS plaintiffs, seemed to focus a lot on the argument that these claims arose from our relationship with Mr. Baumeister. They arose from this long relationship. They didn't arise from the contract. What we have to look back to, though, is the arbitration agreement itself. It doesn't just say we have to arbitrate disputes that arise from the contract or arise under the contract, but they also say we have to arbitrate disputes that arise in connection with the contract or in relation to the contract. And so it doesn't really matter how they phrase it. If they want to say this arises from our long-term friendship with Richard Baumeister, that's fine, but they also arise in connection with these contracts. And so long as that connection is there, then they're subject to arbitration. Now, we talked quite a bit in our brief, as did the appellees, about the capital income properties case. It's a Supreme Court case out of 1992. We talk about it a lot because the facts are awfully similar. In that case, the plaintiffs bought shares of a limited partnership. In that case, the partnership was going to develop a hotel, and the arbitration agreement there was virtually identical to ours. It said not only arising out of or under, but also had the in connection with or in relation to language. And the Supreme Court, again, the allegations were very similar in that they were talking about inducement, fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, things of that nature in arriving to that agreement. The Supreme Court said, doesn't matter that this is not a, you know, essentially a breach of contract case. If you're complaining that they induced you for whatever reason to enter into this contract, it's in connection with, it's in relation to, and therefore you have to arbitrate it. Another case that we talked about mostly with regard to SBNF, but I think is a very appropriate case to discuss a little bit further, is the Meyer versus WMCO case. It is also from the Supreme Court in 2006. The facts were a little bit complicated because it deals with a non-signatory, which is why we discussed it and with regard to SBNF, but I think it's important to look at it in light of the entire case. In that case, dealt with a Ford dealership starting out there. Bullock owned a Ford dealership in West Texas. Ford Motor Company had a right of first refusal that if Mr. Bullock wanted to sell that dealership, Ford could come in and buy it or assign that right to someone else to buy it. Bullock, the dealer, again, contracted with an entity called WMCO to sell his dealership to them, notified Ford of the right of the fact that he was intending to sell it. Ford then assigned its right to purchase it to Meyer. Ford and Meyer are non-parties to that purchase and sale agreement, but the purchase and sale agreement between Bullock and WMCO, the initial buyer, had an arbitration agreement in it. When Ford makes its arrangement with Meyer, so now that Meyer is going to get to buy the dealership, WMCO sues everybody. Obviously, WMCO is subject to an arbitration agreement with Bullock. They're the two parties to that contract. But Ford and Meyer, the two non-parties, then sought to compel arbitration against WMCO so that the entire thing would be arbitrated on the basis that he couldn't ever maintain his claims if that contract never existed. Went to the Court of Appeals, went to the Supreme Court, and in an 8-1 decision authored by Justice Hecht, the court found that to the extent a plaintiff relies on the existence of a contract, if that contract contains an arbitration clause, it is in connection with or relating to that contract and would be subject to arbitration. And to state it just as Justice Hecht did, when a party's right to recover and its damages depend on the agreement containing the arbitration provision, the party is relying on the agreement for its claims.
But isn't that different from the facts alleged here, because it's the fraud in the inducement claim as opposed to any of the terms of the agreement itself?
Well, and that's a good point, Chief Justice Livingston. There is a difference between relying on the terms and relying on the existence of the contract. And what we found in the capital income properties, for example, which is more along the lines of what Your Honor was just saying, that was an inducement to the contract. So long as that contract contains an arbitration provision, it's subject to. In Meyer, they didn't get into the terms either. The allegations were a little bit different as far as causes of action, but it was interesting to read. Justice O'Neill was the only justice who dissented in that case, and she actually wrote about it at length, saying, I don't think this is right. I don't think we should go so far to say, as long as your claim, as long as we're making it the rule, if we're making it the rule that your claim is subject to arbitration, if it cannot exist without the contract, I think that's wrong. Justice O'Neill's position was it should have to go to the terms. You should have to depend on the terms of the contract for it to really be subject to arbitration. The other eight justices disagreed, and that's the opinion that we have. Whether it's right or wrong is not for me to say, but Justice Hecht was pretty adamant that if the only way it can exist is if that contract exists, then you're relying on that contract. And he goes on to discuss it in a little bit of esoteric discussion about direct benefits estoppel and equitable estoppel, but that is the essence of it, of the scope argument.
So doesn't that remove ANS from your arbitration claim completely?
We did not move to compel ANS to arbitrate.
Okay.
Because it's not a party. And interestingly enough, if you flow it through this analysis, they could maintain their claims without any reference at all to these contracts. Our argument about we only sought to stay ANS because the facts are so intertwined. It's the same representations made about the same facts to the same people at the same time. In fact, it was all the same individual that it was made to in his individual capacity versus in a corporate capacity. But because there is no contract relied on, because they never entered into the limited partnership agreements, they just bought into the property directly.
Right.
No, as much as I'd love to, I don't think we can compel them to arbitrate. The best we can hope for is say, let's set those aside while we sort the facts out through arbitration. I do want to, and I'd probably cover that as much as I need to as far as ANS is concerned, but those facts, especially if you look at the paragraph 6 and following in the petition there, the facts are lumped all together between ANS and the other plaintiffs. Finally, I want to talk about SBNF, because that is a little bit more complex of an issue. I think it's easy to say that when you've got parties to a contract that say we should arbitrate, they should have to arbitrate. SBNF takes it a step further because it's not a party, but it is a defendant. And in this case, like in Meyer versus WMCO, what you have is a plaintiff who is relying on the existence of the contract to assert a cause of action against a non-party. And in Meyer, the holding in that case was all about the non-signatory, saying that, in fact, they could enforce it, that so long as the plaintiff is seeking a benefit of that contract, even if it's not a benefit under the terms of the contract, a benefit by that contract's mere existence, that they are estopped then, they are equitably estopped from saying, we shouldn't have to deal with the arbitration. The claims, of course, if you look at them factually, are all the same. Nowhere in the pleadings is there the allegation that SBNF did something different than Baumeister did. Baumeister was the signatory. He was the actor. He was the only person on our side of the table doing anything. And so when you look at that, the facts are the same. The other case that I want to mention in discussing SBNF is In re Merrill Lynch, and we briefed this one. And it gets into a discussion of derivative or vicarious liability. And the facts in In re Merrill Lynch were a little bit different. In that case, you had a suit against an employee, and it was going up to the employer that was the signatory. Our case is a little bit different, where we've got an employee or an agent that was the signatory, and then you've got the employer that is not. When you look at Merrill Lynch, though, what we come back to, as we do with all of these cases, always when you're talking about arbitration, is it's not the technicalities of how it's pleaded, it's what are the facts, and are the facts really different? And in this case, they're not. Just like you see in In re Merrill Lynch, or In re Labatt is another one that talks about vicarious liability. That was a wrongful death case where the claims were being brought by the wife of the deceased, but the deceased man had signed an arbitration agreement. And they said, look, we know that you're different, and a wrongful death claim is different than a personal injury claim, but a wrongful death claim is derivative, just as is a vicarious liability claim or a derivative liability claim of any other kind. When you look at the facts of the actual case at its inception, you've agreed to arbitrate those claims. Those facts are subject to arbitration. And so it shouldn't matter that Mr. Baumeister was either acting in an individual capacity or acting as a representative of SBNF. The facts are that our plaintiffs in this case, with the exception of A, of course, agreed to arbitrate those disputes. And of course, on top of that, we have the general Texas law that's cited in all of our cases about favoring joint resolution of multiple claims to prevent multiple determinations of the same matter, and considering always whether the facts are intertwined. We believe that overall, Your Honors, the court should reverse the ruling of the trial court in both cases denying the order compelling arbitration, for the simple reason that all of the claims in this case of the parties to the limited partnership agreements depend on the agreement, depend on the existence of the agreement at a very minimum containing the arbitration provisions, and accordingly that they're subject to arbitration. And that includes SBNF. It includes SBNF because those claims cannot exist if the contract does not exist. And then secondarily, we'd ask that the court reverse the order denying a stay of all of the claims that are pending in the trial court, including the claims asserted by ANS. Thank you very much.
Was there a claim for excessive fees?
There was, and it's a little bit curious to me. It's not clear to me whether it's just ANS that's asserting it or whether all of the ANS plaintiffs are asserting it. But what is clear, if you look in the petition, and it's in the court clerk's record, it's on page 10, but it's page 7 of the petition where it begins. It talks about management of the partnership, that the partnership was created and managed by SBNF, that the partnership had been charged fees, and that those fees were later passed along to ANS. I don't know quite what this is about, and none of us can. All we know, of course, is what's in the record. But what's clear is that it relies on the existence of the partnership. It relies on management of the partnership by SBNF. And so if this is a claim for fees that are run up, whether they're excessive or not, resulting from management of the partnership, which is what they're complaining about, I don't see how that's not relating to the contract that creates that partnership.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Messer. Paula Nippa. May it please the court, Paula Canipa for appellee James Reagan.
First of all, I'd like to address just a couple of items as an overview in response to what the Mr. Masso discussed. The first was his general proposition that we have such a broad arbitration provision that that says in relation to, in connection to, arising under, a broad array of ways to rope in every conceivable claim. I just want to suggest that there's a danger in allowing arbitration provisions to become so broadly written and so broadly construed that they swallow, as a rule, they swallow every exception. And I believe that's what's threatened to happen here. The second issue I wanted to, as an overview, I wanted to address is the standard of review. In my briefing to the court, I raised it as an abuse of discretion standard. With factual findings reviewed on a de novo basis, legal findings made on a de novo basis, and factual findings made on an abuse of discretion standard. As the court is probably already well aware, no findings of fact were requested in the proceeding below, so there are no findings of fact to review of the findings of fact made by the trial court. I think I'd like to, if it's all right with the court, I'd like to address SBNF first. I think the court, I think Justice Gabriel rightly asked, did SBNF file a motion on its to compel on its behalf? And I believe the suggestion was made that Mr. Baumeister did so on its behalf. He actually did it in his capacity as based on two principles. One, that as a party to the agreement, he was entitled to compel arbitration of any claims arising under, connected, or related to the agreement. The second prong of his reasoning was that he shouldn't be required to litigate twice, because he'll be litigating once as himself individually and then another time as part of the partnership. Not the partnership, but the accounting firm. So I might suggest that SBNF may have waived its right to compel arbitration, not having sought that relief itself. Both of the cases cited by Mr. Masso, In re Meyer and In re Merrill Lynch, were both where the non-party brought the suit to compel arbitration and sought it, and they asserted equitable estoppel as the basis for the court to allow them to compel arbitration. Neither of those things occurred in this case below. Mr. Baumeister, SBNF did not, although it was a party, it did not seek to file a motion to compel on its own behalf. And two, it did not, no assertion of equitable estoppel was made in the proceeding below. I'd like to move back to, unless the court has some questions, I'd like to move back to Mr. Baumeister. I believe this was thoroughly briefed, and I don't want to presume upon the court's attention. I know that y'all have had to read through all of this briefing, but the sum and substance of our argument was that the arbitration clause only applies to claims within the arbitration provision, and tort claims are only arbitrable if they cannot be brought without reference to the contract or agreement itself. I think, as the trial court noted below, the contract itself in this agreement, the partnership agreement in this case, would serve as elements of damages, but what we're talking about is a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And I know that this court is accustomed to parties coming in and trying to avoid arbitration provisions or avoid form selection clauses by saying, well, no, this isn't a breach of contract action. This is really a breach of fiduciary duty claim. In this instance, that is not the case. There's a real valid reason for doing so. What we have are two parties. Mr. Baumeister is serving in two capacities. He's a fiduciary accountant to our client for over 20 years, advising him for that period of time, and there's a whole legacy, a whole history that they have between them of trust, and also just all the attendant laws and common law affecting fiduciary and controlling fiduciary relationships. And then we have Mr. Baumeister, the limited partner, who doesn't owe a fiduciary duty. He's a limited partner under the Allen 75 partnership agreement. So two different hats. I was thinking about this this morning. If Mr. Baumeister, as the fiduciary to Mr. Reagan, had said, hey, I've got this great deal. Don't invest your money in this deal. I've got this great deal over here. And he advises him to go into this transaction over here. But Mr. Baumeister is not part of that limited partnership. He may be getting a kickback from the guy who's running the partnership, but he's not actually a partner in that partnership, and he's not a signatory to that contract. would we still be standing here having this conversation that he should be, that Mr. Reagan should be compelled to arbitrate his breach of fiduciary duty claims against Mr. Baumeister? I mean, I'm hopeful that the answer would be no, because I think that's an analogous. We need to, we're always looking in the law at what and what capacities and what parties are actually, who they actually are. And I think that distinction is important today because it helps separate this case and distinguish this case from some of the other cases where it's a little bit more as though they're really just trying to subvert and avoid the clause.
Given that, how do you distinguish this from the capital income case and cases cited therein?
Well, I know capital properties in particular, they were suing breach of fiduciary within the partnership agreement itself, as I read the case. So the claims are predicated on, within this partnership, you owed me fiduciary duties, and you breached those. In this case, that's not being argued. And I don't...
cited in that Prima Paint Corporation versus Flood and Conklin Manufacturing Company, which wherein it was held that a claim for fraudulent inducement to execute the agreement is a claim that is covered by the arbitration clause.
Well, Justice Gabriel, I will say we've not brought a fraudulent inducement claim in this case. The gravitas or the sum of our complaint against Mr. Baumeister is that you had a financial interest that you failed to disclose. And honestly, under RCV Burroughs, we wouldn't even need to put on that contract as element of damages. The fact that he breached his fiduciary duty by failing to disclose a financial interest, we still get it. We still have a viable claim against them, and we're entitled to damages. SNBF, I'll move on back to SNBF. They weren't a signatory of the contract. The parties didn't contemplate them. The cases that Mr. Masso cites in his brief address where they either impliedly or expressly extended the protections of the contract to other parties by either expanding any agreement, touching upon any agreement existing prior to this agreement will be arbitrated, or these parties who are not necessarily signatories will expressly be considered part of the contract for purposes of this arbitration provision. We don't have, even though there is an expansive reading given to this arbitration provision, this arbitration language doesn't extend that far. And I would suggest that since they're not a signatory or a recognized third-party beneficiary, and actually I'm kind of making a moot argument since they didn't seek to compel either anyway. Mr. Masso addressed an argument that I made. I kind of raised a parade of horribles that would ensue if we just allowed Mr. Baumeister to say any claim that touches upon the agreement can be prosecuted. It will not be prosecuted, but be forced to arbitration. And I think I said something like, well, if somebody were injured, like a contract were injured as part of the construction, this was a real estate development deal. If a contractor were injured or a subcontractor were injured, then they would be forced to have their tort claims, and they're not parties, compelled to arbitration by Mr. Baumeister, because it touches upon, the agreement is all about this Island 75 real estate deal development. So conceivably, if we're going to give an expansive reading, where's the limiting principle on that? Where do we draw the line between in connection to or in relation to? And with respect to Mr. Baumeister's argument that he should not be required to arbitrate twice, I think Morunfula, which is a case cited by us as well as Mr. Masso, puts a fork in that, because the court expressly said that's not the standard, that it's inconvenient for you. It's we're going to adhere to the terms of the contract, and where it requires you to arbitrate, that's what's going to happen. Where the claims don't fall within arbitration, they're going to be tried before a jury. Does the court have any questions for me?
I guess not.
Well, I brought my son's lucky rock with me today, so I'm hopeful that it deflected some of the questioning.
Thank you, Ms. Canepa. Mr. Borland.
May it please the court. I am Richard Borland and represent the what's now been called the ANS plaintiffs. There's two entities and one individual. As the court's correctly noted, only Baumeister has sought arbitration in this matter. I beg to differ with my colleague to my left. I don't think Baumeister said in his motion that he was bringing this with the consent of the accounting firm. In fact, what he says in his motion is, defendant Baumeister is a direct party to the agreement to arbitrate, is entitled to seek enforcement of its terms. It does not say, and I'm doing so on behalf of the accounting firm. That was what was in the underlying court. I was there at the hearing. There was no discussion, as I recall, saying that it was being brought with the consent of the accounting firm, which, if you'll note, the motion itself is entitled Defendant Baumeister's Motion to Compel Arbitration as to Fastlanes and Don Smith and a non-party to this appeal. Only briefly does it mention the accounting firm, and only briefly does it mention ANS, and all they ask with regard to ANS is it be stayed. I also disagree with what counsel has said. He said it's all the same parties. ANS is owned by a gentleman by the name of Adam Smith. He is the son of Don Smith. Don Smith and Adam Smith met with Baumeister separately concerning this investment in Houston Street. The statements made to Adam Smith on behalf of ANS, although similar, and it's more a failure to represent as to the statements made to Don Smith, were made to him at separate times in separate places. So it is, although facts will be similar, and with regard to the failures to represent, certainly the same, they were not done at the same time, and they're not the same people. Just to make it really brief, I know y'all have read the briefs, and I will not recite them, and I certainly won't go over what counsel's already gone over, but my case involves two different partnerships. Allen 75, Fastlane was an investor, was induced into it, and was not advised of the financial interest that his longtime accountant and financial advisor had. Mr. Baumeister, I know I've stated in the brief, he and his family took out $291,000 as a result of these people, including Mr. Reagan, investing in that partnership. We were totally unaware of that, certainly unaware that the purchase contract was signed on behalf of the buyer and the seller by the same individual. A real question of whether the contract was even arm's length, and certainly as a result of what will be developed at the trial, the total loss of this partnership is certainly wasn't arm's length transaction. Only Mr. Baumeister and his people made money out of this. The Houston Street is a completely different investment. ANS, as you know from the briefing, bought a half interest in the property. As I mentioned in the briefing, ANS sold some property, did not intend to reinvest in real estate, but the accountant and CPA, Mr. Baumeister, convinced Adam Smith, who owns ANS, to invest in a half interest in this property. He didn't buy an interest in the partnership because he couldn't have gotten like kind of exchange, tax deferment, so Mr. Baumeister convinced him to buy a half interest, and then Mr. Adam Smith's father bought an interest in the limited partnership. As you know from the briefing, it's another failure to represent. They sold it for $1.8 million. Mr. Baumeister was holding an appraisal for $1.65 million, didn't mention the clients, didn't mention the cost of what it was going to cost to develop it properly, and certainly failed to mention until his deposition that he received a portion of the real estate commission in that transaction. First, I want to talk about ANS. ANS, not a party to any partnership agreement. They do make a claim in the pleadings, as I recall my pleadings, that there's excessive billing for accounting. But that's them individually, not as a limited partner. I do not think that claim relates to any of the other plaintiffs in that case. I could be wrong, but I don't believe so, and I think I checked it yesterday, although at my age I do forget a few things here and there. So certainly ANS, there is no argument that can be made ANS should be in the arbitration, and I don't believe they are making an argument. They certainly didn't in the trial court. In fact, they advised the trial court, we're not seeking arbitration as to ANS. They are seeking to stay the litigation against ANS, which they only mentioned that. They didn't go through the steps I think would be necessary to do that. And as I've already mentioned the court, although the allegations from this failure to represent are the same, the facts will be different the representations and opportunities and so forth will be different because the representations and the dealings between the owner of ANS and Mr. Baumeister occurred at different time and places than Don Smith, the father of Adam Smith, at the time that he invested, Don Smith invested in Limited Partnership.
So your position is that ANS can proceed with its litigation because it's basically different facts?
It's different facts, same failures to represent, but different facts to get there. It is a separate and distinct organization with the right to proceed with its own litigation. As counsel, I think, implied that it was the same people. Don Smith, an investor in Houston Street Limited Partners, is only the father of the owner of ANS. So they're not the same people, obviously related, but it's a different entity. And yes, Your Honor, I think ANS ought to be allowed to proceed with its litigation in the courts here. With regard to the accounting firm, I've already mentioned, I don't see in their motion where they said, Baumeister said anything to the effect that this is being brought with the consent of the accounting firm. I think he's out on a really weak limb with regard to that argument. They only asked in their motion that the accounting firm be sent to arbitration. And interestingly, they refer to this Meyer case, and counsel referred to it in his argument. And as I read the Meyer case, there's really some really serious distinctions that the court will be interested in reviewing this matter. First of all, the party seeking arbitration and seeking it under this Meyer concept of equitable estoppel actually moved for arbitration as opposed to the accounting firm in this case did not. And as I mentioned, the weakness in their argument that Baumeister did on with the consent of the accounting firm. But the Supreme Court in Meyer, in talking about equitable estoppel to allow non-signatory to compel arbitration, said there's really two bases on it, and I believe that's on page 305 of that opinion. But it says something to the effect that first, equitable estoppel applies when the signatory to the written agreement containing the arbitration clause must rely on the terms of the written agreement in asserting a claim against the non-signatory. My plaintiffs aren't relying on any of the terms within the partnership in bringing this case. That just happens to be the investment that Fastlane's made and that Don Smith made, not seeking, as in the capital case that we'll talk about in a minute, the capital income case. They're not claiming of any wrongdoing within the terms of the partnership. It could have been any other investment. It just happened to be that investment. So the first provision that would permit a non-signatory who actually moves for arbitration to have arbitration doesn't apply to this case. And the second one, the court said, application of equitable estoppel is warranted when the signatory to the contract containing the arbitration clause raises allegations substantially independent and concerted misconduct, both by the non-signatory and one of the signatories. In other words, some sort of conspiracy. There's no such allegation. So as I read the Meyer case that's cited by the appellants in their reply, it doesn't apply to this particular situation. So I want to point that out to the court. The counsel also refers to the Merrill Lynch case. As I recall, that case, relating to the stay was denied, and an arbitration was not ordered for that particular party, if I recall that correctly. Finally, Your Honor, I want to talk about, I shouldn't say finally, I have two things I want to talk about. My claim of ambiguity. The clause reads, any dispute or controversy arising out or under in connection with in relationship to agreement that has not and cannot be resolved under section 9.1 shall be exclusively resolved by arbitration. 9.1 is that clause I just read, and you're nodding your head, so I'm sure you've read this. It's circular. You go around and around and around. So there's, in my mind, an ambiguity that you don't know how you reach the arbitration. Maybe they meant to say by mediation. Maybe they meant to say by some other source. Maybe there's a whole lot of things they could have said, but they didn't. So I think there's an ambiguity that the court's got to deal with, and I think it's ambiguous. That clause is ambiguous and should not be enforced. Again, I'll say none of my plaintiffs are relying on any of the terms of the partnership agreements in bringing this action. They are complaining about the investment that Mr. Baumeister, their longtime CPA, led them into. Finally, I want to talk very briefly about the capital, and I think I just mentioned it, the capital income properties case. It's distinguishable again, and I think maybe Paul has mentioned it, because most of the claims arose from allegations dealing with the management of the partnership. There were allegations about fraudulent inducement. I think the court found they were so intertwined that you'd send it all to arbitration. But that case, unlike this case, dealt with allegations within the partnership, allegations of misdoing within the partnership, whereas that is not what we're dealing with in this particular case. I appreciate the court's time. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Borland. All right, Mr. Messo.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just waiting on my green
Brown,
light.
Ms. Brown, are you ready? Okay. Tell us when you're ready. Well, we'll see it. There you go.
There we go.
Thank you.
I'm going to sort of go in reverse as far as the issues, how I started. I'm going to start with the ANS issue because something that Mr. Borland said concerned me. I heard him say several times that the facts are going to be different, that maybe the allegations are that similar things happened and we ended up in the same place, or that we were dealing with some of the same people but not all the same people. The problem, the concern that gives me is that here today we're only looking at the pleadings. And if you look at the pleadings, starting on page 8 of the clerk's record in the ANS case, what you find are that the allegations as far as what happened to ANS, what Mr. Baumeister and SBNF did or allegedly did to ANS, are lumped in with Mr. Smith. It's ANS and Smith, the defendants represented and warranted to ANS and Smith that the Houston Street property was worth substantially more. Representation was false and a material representation, and that ANS and Smith would not have invested with the intent that ANS and Smith would rely on it and act upon it. ANS and Smith did rely on such representation. So that very well may be that someday we'll hear that the facts are different and that some of the testimony may be different and that maybe some of the misrepresentations happened at different times. But when we compare the pleadings to the arbitration agreement, what we find is that the allegations are lumped in together. And at this point, we have no way of discerning other than that, because, of course, there wasn't a factual determination. This is a legal determination. Do the pleadings fit the agreement? And in this case, they overlap enough. Even though ANS is not subject to arbitration, we concede that. ANS has to be stayed just because, and the only reason theirs is stayed is because they had a different structure. The underlying facts were the same. And I wanted to point this out just because I didn't say it before, but claims that are brought in a case, in a trial court, if some claims are subject to arbitration, the remaining claims must be stayed under 171.025 unless they can be severed. And in this case, there's no way that they can be severed, especially under these pleadings, because the facts overlap heavily. There's no way to show that the facts are completely independent of each other. And again, with the mention of the fee argument came up, the fee dispute, I think, again, if you look at the pleadings, that has a lot to do with the partnerships, and so it's very difficult to extract that either. Dealing with the SBNF issue as to whether they properly moved, whether they filed the right motion, I took a look while Mr. Borland was speaking and while Ms. Kniffa was speaking at our motion in the ANS case in particular. Just as an example, it's the same in both cases. But in the clerk's record, beginning at page 96 in the ANS case, is where the portion of our motion dealing with SBNF begins. And it goes on for, looks like about 2.5 pages. And this is where Mr. Baumeister moves on behalf of SBNF, not in a representative capacity, but he is moving as a party to the contract to enforce the contract. The contract says that any agreements relating to or in connection with the limited partnership agreement has to be arbitrated. Obviously, the dispute with SBNF touches on that contract, and so he's seeking enforcement of it.
He read that motion, and it didn't say what he read anyway, didn't say anything about it being on behalf of SBNF.
It is not brought on behalf of, like you would think of a corporate officer doing something on behalf of the corporation. Mr. Baumeister is seeking to force into arbitration the claims against himself and the claims against SBNF. He is bringing it in his capacity as a party to the contract, as a party to the arbitration agreement.
Why don't you read us that part that you seem to be going toward that will provide us that information?
It's 2.5 pages long, but I will read you a couple of excerpts. And what he said, the section begins, that this is on 96 in the clerk's record, though not a party to the limited partnership agreements, defendant Sanford, Baumeister, and Frazier is also entitled to arbitration of plaintiff's claims. It goes into some of the exceptions to the usual rule that a party must ordinarily be a signatory. Law goes on, defendant Baumeister, this is on page 97 of the clerk's record, defendant Baumeister is a direct party to the agreements to arbitrate and is entitled to seek enforcement of their terms. At the end of the section on page 98 of the clerk's record, it concludes, defendant Baumeister seeks to compel arbitration of those claims, referring to the SBNF claims, with defendant Sanford, Baumeister, and Frazier's consent to submit to arbitration. And this pleading, of course, is signed not only by, it's not just signed as counsel for Mr. Baumeister, it's signed by counsel for defendants, including both Baumeister and SBNF. And so, though it's not brought in the name of SBNF, it's brought as a motion to compel arbitration of those claims, which claims are against SBNF. The Meyer case, and we've been round and round the Meyer case, but what I wanted to point out just one last time is, if you read Justice Heck's opinion, the 8-1 majority, and then you read Justice O'Neill's dissent, you really see the difference in what I am saying versus what counsel to my right are saying. You don't have to rely on the terms. I know they don't rely on the terms of these contracts for their cases. They don't have to. They don't need to. It doesn't matter as far as I'm concerned, but they are relying on the existence of the contract for the SBNF claim, as well as the direct claims that are brought by the members of the partnership, which brings me to the general scope argument, the main reason we're here. As soon as Ms. Canepa stood up, she said, you know, the rule is tort claims aren't subject to arbitration unless they can't be brought without reference to the contract. Without reference to the contract. And my question is, what is this case about? Can you have this case if the contract doesn't exist? Can you plead your case without making reference to the contract? And they can't. Because they can't, N. Ray Meyer, the Supreme Court, has said that those claims are subject to arbitration. Would it be different if you know, she gave the example of, would it be different if Mr. Baumeister had referred them to a completely different investment, one that he was not involved in? And the question then came up, well, would that be subject to arbitration if that invest? Let's say he referred them to a mutual fund from Fidelity Investments, and Fidelity Investments standard agreement says anything arising out of this in relation to or connection with had to be brought in arbitration. If they then sued Mr. Baumeister for inducing them to invest in that mutual fund, I think the answer is yes. He would be subject to arbitration if he wanted to pursue it, because they are bringing it with reference to, in connection with, undoubtedly, that contract that they entered into at his suggestion. And so I think the answer to that question is yes. The parade of horribles I thought was interesting. I won't go through all of it again, but again, the question is, the examples that were made in Reagan's brief dealt with things like premises liability and quantum merit. None of those touch on the contract. None of those have anything to do with the contract that formed the partnership agreement. But all of the claims they've brought do. They can't support any of those claims without talking about the contract, and because they can't, they're subject to arbitration.
No one's talked about substantially invoked the litigation process and or waiver of the right to compel. What's your position on that?
I don't think it's an issue. I think it's moot now. I think we raised that out of an abundance of caution in case they were going to argue that we had waived our right to arbitrate.
Okay.
But both groups of plaintiffs have conceded that they don't assert any waiver arguments. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, counsel, we appreciate your arguments today and all of your briefing, extensive briefing, and hard work on this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused, and we will now adjourn court.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.